three times and got told the same thing.
Yeah.
And then I called yesterday. I got a different agent. I was like, hey, I'd like to, I see there's obvious availability. I transfer the points in. I'd like to apply them to this reservation. And she's like, oh yeah, let me see what I can do. And then just did it.
I have no love for BA other than the fact that typically the fares for what I use are cheaper.
Yeah. I mean, this is actually, it's cheaper than in a premium economy on United. I mean, by like $300. It was like 2200.
That's close.
Yeah. It's like 2200, but like $2,200 for premium economy is not terrible. It's not great. I mean, it's like, that should be a business class fare, in my opinion, but
yeah. Anyway. It's also like I paid $1,000 for premium economy, but it's Europe originating.
Yeah. See, if I was originating in Europe, I think it would be better. I mean, maybe that's what I should do is just start nesting tickets, but I can't plan that.
Can't work, though.
Yeah.
And I know I'll get burned eventually. Like I've already had to throw away. I've done it twice now. I had to throw a couple away, but
yeah,
I've had some that didn't work out.
Yeah.
I always do, but I still
have come out well ahead. I like to think.
I mean, cause you, like if you have a change or something, you just basically forfeit the ticket. Like if you have something that comes up for the return.
Well, it depends. So I think you pay, there is a change fee on them, mm-hmm. whereas US originating don't have change fees.
Yep.
So that is one quirk, but like I had one that I was, you know, had a ticket with a return in, you know, it was supposed to be in July. And then I was like, oh, well, and this is before they had change fees on. So it was kind of okay. But then I was like, I was able to push it out to October and then I pushed it out. And it actually, I almost could have used it for January based on the original. I issued it January 16th of 2024.
Yeah.
But because of it's only valid for a year, it was a day off from when I could actually leave. And I couldn't leave the day earlier. So I ended up forfeiting it. But like I changed it two or three times and whatnot, that, you know, trying to make it still work for whatever the next trip that I was going to take was.
Yeah, yeah.
But eventually all those trips didn't happen for one reason or another. And I just gave up the return half. But even that still, like, you know, you're talking about a $2,200 round trip premium economy, like that's $1,000 each way. If I paid $1,000 for it and I only used it one way, I still basically, at worst, I broke even.
Yeah. I mean, that's very true. Like if something went bad and you had to abandon one of the segments, it's like, okay, it still came out what it would be to come from the US. So
yeah.
You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Foz Mamoon, and Seth Miller.
Hello, and welcome to episode 516 of Dots, Lines, and Destinations. I'm Stephen Seagraves, joined this week by Mr. Foz Mamoon and Seth Miller. Honorable Seth Miller.
That's right.
Of various honors.
I think I'm just going to address you that way every time.
I appreciate it.
Well, a lot has happened since our last show, since we took a little bit of a short break. So I guess we can just start with the two crashes that happened while we were gone. The first one being Azerbaijan Air, which looks to be a Russian shootdown. While it was flying from, Baku? No, was it Baku? And then to Grozny, and it went down over Kazakhstan, right?
Yeah, there's some, you know, a couple of weird things here. I think we certainly still don't have all the answers, obviously, but one of the bits that came out that is the most interesting is that Russia has apologized for it happening while not explicitly saying it was responsible for shooting the plane down. And there's decent amount of evidence suggesting that anti-aircraft fire in around near Grozny during a drone attack hit this plane as well, which raises questions like, why didn't they tell the plane to divert earlier and close the airspace because they were under attack and things like that. Also, and this is, you know, the sort of very interesting thing that we probably will never get the answer to is why ultimately did the plane have to divert back across the Caspian Sea to Kazakhstan instead of somewhere else at a closer airport, you know, in Chechnya or elsewhere, with the one theory that is, you know, Russia was hoping the plane would crash in the bottom of the sea and no one would ever find the evidence, so it's okay that they were responsible, versus maybe there was a real reason, and we don't know.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing to me so many people survived the crash, because the plane was very much out of control, it felt like. And so it's amazing that so many people survived. I think that is a testament to modern aircraft builds and the pilots. Yeah, I think the pilots did an amazing job. and the air crew. I think, you know, getting people off, I think it's speaks to them. It's tragic. This isn't the first time that Russia's, you know, shot down an airplane. Especially, I mean, Grozny should have been closed. The drone attack, as far as we know, was going on for hours at that point.
So that's really weird that, like,
even just a note ham, like, hey, you might want to reconsider because, you know, there's guns firing around our airport. I don't know.
I read that there's like another theory of like why they diverted to Kazakhstan was because there was also GPS spoofing going on at the same time, messing up navigation to, you know, some other location, and
other closer airports, and the pilots just bugged out.
Let's just get back over the water, you know. Yeah. I don't know. That's hard to verify. You can't until they get interviewed and, you know, everybody's spoken to. So
the pilots both have odd. Maybe have the CVR, the black box, the cockpit voice recorder. So we'll see what data is in it. That was another thing actually about that incident, is some concern of where the black boxes would be taken for analysis. And it seems that if I remember correctly, they chose Brazil as the state of manufacture of the aircraft.
Okay.
One of the interesting things about aircraft incidents and international travel is there's always sort of jockeying for jurisdictional control. And so it happened in Azerbaijan. It happened in Kazakhstan. The plane is registered in Azerbaijan. It was vaguely in Russia for part of the time. The plane was manufactured in Brazil. Like any and all of those countries will want to have some participation in the review. And, you know, if Russia had managed to get the black boxes sent there, the data reported likely would have been very different.
That's always
right. Like, yeah. Basically what I'm saying. And not all countries have the necessary expertise and systems available to do that analysis.
Yep. Yeah. I think my wife actually asked me, because of the other crash that we're going to talk about, she was like, well, who all gets to investigate it? And I mean, there's a lot of people who get invited to investigate as well, right? Like usually engine manufacturers come, if there's any question of that, if there's, yep, you know, those kind of things. So a lot of people get invited and they all give their opinion. And then it gets filed into a report. And I think there was the Egypt air crash. There was two conflict, like Egypt did their own investigation and France did their own investigation, and they came to two different conclusions, which I found interesting.
Yeah. And if I remember correctly on that one, like France publishing its own findings was atypical.
Yes.
Typically the country where the incident occurred owns and manages the investigation and invites in relevant parties and outsources bits as needed, but they, as the country of incident, own the final report typically.
Correct. Yeah.
And didn't the same thing happen with Egypt Air 990?
Which one's that?
The 763 that was nosedived from JFK to Cairo.
They said that it was false. I think Egypt came in and said no, the initial report isn't true. I think trying to save face a little bit. Yeah,
I thought they did their own after that, though. After that one, they came out.
They might have. I can look it up. Yeah. Yeah. So let's. Yeah. Anyway, let's talk about the other crash. Jeju Air crashed. I don't know how to pronounce the airport name. Muan? Is it Muan?
Sure.
And it's again one of these situations where we don't really know everything yet, but it appears the plane maybe had a bird strike at some point before the crash. It then made a wheels up landing pretty far down the runway and then hit a retaining wall or ILS system wall. And all but two people were killed on the plane. So a lot of fatalities, unfortunately.
And the two people were the two FA sitting all the way in the back.
Yeah.
If I remember.
I think they were deadheading pilots, but yeah, they were crew.
Yeah. One question that I had was, it looked like the thrust reversers were deployed. I thought you couldn't deploy the thrust reversers unless the wheel sensors are engaged.
I didn't see any that showed that deployed. So,
okay. So maybe it's just marking.
At one point there was conversation there. So one of the things that was interesting about this to me is that there's a lot of things interesting about it. Like it was headed north to land, headed north, and then its ADS-B dropped off. It stopped transmitting. That happened to be around the time of this reported bird strike. So is it possible that a bird hit that antenna on the body and like stopped that transmission? Yes. Among other things that could have been, could have affected. Obviously the plane was still flying. So the black boxes, the CVR and the FDR should have some of this data in them. And I believe those have both been recovered as well. So we will get that analysis at some point, but it basically the plane skipped that northerly landing, went up, did a loop, and then sort of immediately did a wheels up landing to the south, with no flaps and slats extended. So it was going pretty fast. And I don't know if that's standard for a wheels up landing or not. Doing a wheels up landing in a 737 at all is kind of bizarre, because there are, even if the hydraulic systems are blown, there is or should be a physical wire that connects from the control column to the wheels. And if you like push it all the way past, you know, to the end and then past, there's a physical pin that comes out and gravity drops the wheels into place and locks them out. You can't take them back up once that's done, but that's way better than trying to do a belly up landing. So like, did the pilots try that and it didn't work? Did they not try that? We don't know. Hopefully the CVR will reveal some of that and maybe a reason why. And then it seems like it was a very quick effort to immediately get on the ground, which I understand after many hours of flying up from Bangkok and having an emergency, you'd want to do that. But if you have control of the aircraft in the air, and it seems like they had pretty good control because they were, other than coming in long, pretty good lineup for that wheels up landing. Why did they sort of rush to get on the ground instead of trying some other things? And, you know, right, like we see other reports of aircraft with landing gear issues, like flying past the control tower a couple times for a visual confirmation and whatnot. I'm sure there are good reasons for all of this, but it seems to me like the emergency landing was a bit rushed. And like I don't know that the fire department had deployed. They weren't ready. Like, not that they weren't ready, but oftentimes if you're doing a wheels up landing, like the fire department is out at the end of the runway waiting for you, not still needing to dispatch. And from the video I saw, it didn't seem like they were already deployed. I don't know. There's some weird stuff going on there.
Yeah. I had seen one person do some analysis of like the plane, and they wondered maybe if the bird strike had actually, if it had hit multiple birds and it included the cockpit, and maybe one penetrated the cockpit potentially. And so they, maybe the pilots were trying to just get the plane on the ground.
Yeah.
I mean, that's possible.
Like I said, it's entirely possible there's a reason for the sort of, I don't want to say rushed, but what seems like rushed experience.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird. Like the coming right back, not putting the gear down. They were very fast in the landing. They put it down very far down the runway. So they didn't even have time to slow down. It looks like from the placement.
The thing about a belly landing is you're basically depending on gravity or friction as your brakes, and you need space for that, right? And then this also triggered a whole lot of conversations of like, A, why is there a giant concrete embankment at the end of the runway? And B, why isn't there EMAS, the engineered material arresting system, which like you get at the end of the runways at LaGuardia and Midway and other places where even Logan has it going into the water. I know, like places where overrunning the runway is a guaranteed bad idea. Arguably with a giant concrete wall at the end, overrunning the runway here is a guaranteed bad idea. But obviously they didn't expect it here. And that's one of those things, like those things cost money and you don't put them everywhere because of that. But yeah, maybe it needed to be, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's big questions about like the ILS system itself, and you know, is that required? The runways, I think, has been expanded in the past. So, like, you know, should they have made the expansion or made changes to the other end, that kind of thing? I don't know. It's tragic, right? For the entire plane to be lost due to this. So, very, very interested to see what the results are.
Yeah.
Your question about Egypt Air 990, Foz. So, Egyptian government rejected the NTSB's conclusion and insisted that the crash was caused by mechanical failure. They didn't issue their own report, but they gave their own translation or interpretation of the pilot's words as he was speaking from the CVR.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah. Let's talk about BA.
This hasn't been talked to death?
No, I mean, it's in the notes. So they're going revenue based for status. It's a big change for them.
A drastic revenue base, no less.
Yeah. So, okay. Explain to everybody how today BA works for people who don't understand.
So BA status works on this concept of tier points. And so tier points are awarded based on the class of service and the distance of the flight. And I think you max out at like 140 is the most tier points you can get from a flight.
Okay.
And so BA Silver, which is One World Sapphire, requires 600 tier points, and BA Gold requires 1500, if I remember correctly. And so the amount of Avios you earn is nowhere related to how you get status. So status right now, to be fair, status can be obtained reasonably easily by doing short-haul domestic flights with multiple connections.
Okay.
So in the U.S., because AA has liberal riding rules, you could do a double connection and do like two of those trips and have the bulk of the tier points you need. So you could do something like...
Yes and no. I mean, yes, you can. The short hops get you points, but especially within the U.S. and on the lowest fare classes, there's decidedly small value point values, like 5 or 10.
Well, and I should clarify, in the premium cabin, so you could book something like Nashville to D.C. for $200, but do a double connect.
Yeah. Yes, and get, what, 20 or 40 points per segment?
40 per segment, I think it is. So, like, it adds up pretty quickly. Now, the rub of BA is you have to have 4 BA segments. So either you get your Tookus over to the UK and start flying around a little bit, or you go down to the Caribbean and do some of their Fifth Freedom flights.
What do they do down in the Caribbean? I guess some of the hops between the islands.
Exactly. Like St. Lucia to Grand Cayman or something like that. They've got like 2 or 3 tag flights down there that you can actually book just the tag segment.
Okay. Just also minor correction. There's like the ultra long haul stuff, like Heathrow Singapore and first is 240 points or 160 in business. So there are some higher earning, but yes.
There, yeah. But, and I knew, I thought there was more, but I just couldn't remember. So,
yeah.
So that's the gist of it.
What's changing is the move away from that?
Yes. No more tier points.
Oh, okay. How are they measuring it then?
Pounds spent.
Revenue based.
Yeah.
What a surprise.
So the thing is, like, I'm not surprised that they went revenue based. You know, arguably this has been a long time coming. Where it's interesting to me is sort of what some of the numbers are. So, right, like, Foz, you started at silver. There's also bronze, which is the lower tier, which doesn't get you much, but gets you a couple of things. It was 300 points before. Now it's 3,500 pounds, right, before taxes and government fees, but including fuel surcharges. Silver goes to 7,500, and gold goes to 20,000. And these are pounds, not dollars. So even if comparing to, like, a Delta at 28,000 for diamond, if you want to say that BA gold is equivalent to Delta diamond, it's sort of close. If you think, you know, there's also gold guest list, which is the super top elite. And arguably there's some difference between gold and diamond that, you know, especially because gold gets access to first class lounges and Delta just Sky Team doesn't do that kind of stuff. But gold guest list being at 65,000 is incredibly high for first-time qualifiers, and then 40,000 to renew.
Yeah,
that basically comes in like the theoretical global services or concierge key level.
So the monetary listing is it's a lot. Like, there's a monetary value. It's a lot more compared to comparable programs.
But wait, what's United's 1K number these days?
Is it 32 now?
28,000 with 28,000 with no segment requirement.
Okay, so, you know, gold, 20,000 pounds is about $25,000.
Yeah.
Is 1K the same as gold? Who can say? It's. I also would argue 1K is stupidly expensive, so I don't know.
Yeah.
It might not be out of line compared to the rest of the market. It is still stupidly expensive to me.
I'm 100% with you. I think it's kind of wild.
They're all stupidly expensive.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess people are spending it, right? I mean, BA must have the data to say, look, for gold guest list, our highest tier, this is how much people are spending. So we think we can get this revenue from people who fly us. People are also very BA captive, right?
Maybe, maybe not, right? If you insist on nonstop, like, it depends, right? If you're just doing long hauls, yeah, there's a lot of people who live in like Germany and don't fly Lufthansa by default, or live in the UK and fly Sky Team or Star and just connect in the mainland.
Yeah.
Because the fares tend to be much more competitive.
Mm. Yeah.
And again, it also depends on where you're going. And if, like, you know, in the US, there are options that are not BA to many cities nonstop. Right. I mean, I can look here, but flying not BA from Heathrow to the United States or to North America, so including Canada, you know, there are. Okay, well, that didn't work the way it was supposed to. Thanks. Sure. I'm going to try one more time. Nope. Cool. Okay.
this version of the report doesn't like me. Let me switch. But right, like even just beyond Virgin, you got Virgin, which has its collection, and then all of the major U.S. carriers have, or North American carriers have flights to Heathrow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not, and it's not nearly as many. BA has more, especially to the smaller cities. But Air Canada has, here we go. Air Canada, American has Boston, Charlotte, DFW, JFK, Las Vegas, LA, Heathrow, Miami, O'Hare, Philly, Raleigh. I'm sure the Vegas is, it was a one-off for this month for ES.
That's what I was going to ask. I'm like, are you sure that's just not just CES?
Yeah, that's got to be CES. So, but right, like American has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 destinations. Air Canada has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's Aero Mexico. JetBlue still has Boston and JFK. Delta has 7, and United has all of its hubs as well.
Yep.
If you're going to big cities, and then Virgin has basically all of its major routes plus some Delta hubs. If you're going to big cities and WestJet, you've got options. Mm-hmm. If you want like the Nashville and the Austin, those are BA.
BA drop Austin?
Virgin dropped it and BA was growing it.
Maybe that's what I think that's what it is. Yeah.
Anyway, yes. So arguably it's a little harder for the short haul folks who need to get into cities in Europe because you either go to a competing hub and connect, or you take a nonstop on BA.
Yeah.
There's a lot more markets there that are non-hub that are served nonstop.
So, I mean, BA, there's not a lot of incentive for BA to not do this because their competition at Heathrow is doing this already, right? I mean, everybody except maybe Air Canada is revenue-based, or is Air Canada revenue-based now too?
They're revenue-based.
Yeah. So,
Alaska's not, right?
Alaska's not. They don't fly to Heathrow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I see that happening, but okay.
London's going to be there in a couple of years. That's part of the plan. They haven't explicitly stated it, but they've been pretty close.
That's true. Very true. So, I mean, I think it's disappointing. I mean, we have some mutual friends that fly BA quite a bit, and they are just thinking it's, you know, they're not going to get renewal for the highest tier this next year because of this. And you know, I think it sucks, right? It's kind of like me with United. So is there any other way to earn points, or these points that they're listing, rather than just flying? Is there give them money?
BA Vacations, which is a different way of giving them money.
Yeah.
And are they the one that are doing SAF?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Same credit cards. Very limited earnings on the Amex credit card, but that's only in the UK. I don't think there hasn't been, like, there's a Chase card in the US that hasn't had any details released about earnings. So
interesting. Anything else you guys want to talk about with it? Or is it, were either of you putting stuff towards BA, like putting your flying towards BA?
I am actually BA Silver now, I think for the next like couple weeks. And I have, we were talking about this. I'm going over to Europe in a couple of weeks. I've got a level flight, which is technically Iberia code.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm not sure how all the partners will credit it, and it's a premium economy ticket, but it's a standard Iberia flight number for now. And then coming back, I've got a premium economy originating in Madrid, and then going back across, you know, it's Madrid, Miami, and then Boston, Hamburg, double open jaw in premium economy, that even though BA is not a great place to credit it to, from a status perspective, like those three flights would have been enough basically for bronze status. Although I would have had only one of the four segments I needed at that point, because the overwater fits are both on AA. But you know, I look at that. If I credit it to American is the loyalty points program, and so it's 5 points per dollar spend. And this is an AA plate. Well, actually, I think they're both AA plated tickets, so they got the numbers on them. But I think I would have a total of like 5,000 loyalty points, because it was only $1,000 round trip premium economy ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 40,000 to American gold status, which is a pretty low tier, right? So is that worth it? Yeah, probably not. Arguably my best place to spend it in terms of progress towards elite status is Alaska Airlines, which gets me about 12,000 points towards the 20 I think I need for whatever the lowest tier is of Alaska MVP.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure having that tier is worth it, and I don't know what else I'm going to do this year. So,
yeah. I mean, so do you still get, when you put these, this flying towards, BA, you still get Avios as well, right? Like that's part of the draw, is that you at least have Avios?
Yeah, but those are also revenue-based earnings, so it's not like they get many of those.
Oh, okay. Yeah, fair.
And the changes take effect April 1st, if I remember correctly. So if you qualify between now and the end of March, it's
that ain't happening.
That ain't happening.
My program years, I'm not going out of my way to try to qualify for anything, right? And I think, the interesting thing about this to me is like, for the casual leisure passenger who used to game the system and get status to make their life better for travel, what we're seeing again and again is airlines make it easier and easier to say, you know what? I'm just going to buy a cheap premium fare where I can find it and take that trip that way than chasing status so I might get an upgrade or might get the lounge access. And it is easier for me to say that as someone who doesn't have kids, is not beholden to holiday schedules and schools and things like that. But we still do some travel over typical holiday periods. And I've found that the status side of things often is less valuable than just buying the seats I want. And it's been that way for a while, but more and more, I think for mostly leisure passengers, that is going to become the case. If you're traveling more frequently than I do and doing it for business, especially, the status probably still makes some sense.
Yeah. I had someone ask me that question. They're like, well, cause I, you know, moving to Alaska, they say, yeah. Well, why do you care? And they're like, why don't you just buy the premium fares and and on whoever has the best schedule. And I don't think that's it's not a terrible idea. I think for me though, like having the frequent flyer status on someone, at least when I do travel personally, I can use that status to help myself. I'm still on the fence on whether Alaska is the best program for me or not. Like, I think the idea of upgrades on United at this point, sure they happen domestically randomly, but I think even the international plus points upgrades, I think United's doing themselves a disservice by not being able to find that space, because now they're having to offer these, we don't even know what they're going to be yet, right? Like these experiences with plus points, we're using it as another currency. So even those upgrades have been hard for people to find. And if you want to go with three or four people in your family and upgrade everybody, that's close to impossible. Unless it's off season. So I don't know. Like I think it's a tough call unless you're doing it for business. I think you're right, Seth. Like people, the value for people, I think the value proposition just isn't there.
And it's especially hard for we've all played this game for, I hate to say this word, decades now, and seeing the evolution. And right, I could go on and on about how it used to be 60,000 one pass points to get two people to Sydney in first class.
Oh, God.
It's an inside joke there for those. I mean, that was actually was a redemption value, but there's a special inside joke there. Sorry, listeners. Right. We could talk about that too. I don't think that's a good idea. And right. Like, yes, programs have changed. They've devalued. They've shifted towards being better revenue generators for the airlines, especially with the credit card programs and how the shift in earning has developed. Doesn't mean the programs are dead, but parts of them are certainly less valuable than they used to be, depending on your travel patterns.
Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head, right? Like these programs weren't revenue generators 20 years ago. Like that wasn't their intended purpose.
They weren't direct revenue.
Exactly. Like they were to drive people's buying decisions, and they were used as to incentivize that.
About this a couple weeks ago with the Delta Investor Day, where they basically said, giving away quote unquote free upgrades for elites was the biggest loss leader we ever ran as a business.
Yeah. But I think it was also a different economy. You know, I'm using that word in air quotes, but it was a different time. Like the view of coach versus first class was, I don't know. We were just in a different time of flying. I think everybody's trying to remember something that, I don't know that the airlines could have sold that much first back then, right? Like there was a time when airlines were shrinking the first class cabin domestically. Do you guys remember that?
Yeah.
Like,
but they were also still trying to charge a 10 to 20X premium for that product. I think what they realized is eventually people will pay a little more, not a lot more, but it's worth it to get those people to pay a little more rather than getting them to pay
nothing.
Get someone to pay $100 more for the first class seat than getting them to pay $25 more for the economy seat versus a competitor.
Yeah.
And for the upgrade, right? Like one in the hand is worth, in this case, I use numbers that are four in the bush, so think, right? And so the numbers aren't just that simple, but it's a lot.
But I would argue that one of the things they've done in this shift of grabbing every penny possible they've removed the exclusivity of first class, right? The caliber of person sitting up front has dropped drastically, and it's a much less pleasurable experience because of that.
That is all sorts of terrible thing to say.
But it's true.
You don't like people picking their feet in first class?
No. Cutting their nails, picking their feet, like any of the stuff.
You don't think that shit didn't happen 20 years ago?
Not as much as it happens now.
I mean, it's all anecdotal, right? It's all from our own experiences. Like,
it's why the tracksuits offend you.
That's a fair, but that's a fair statement, right? Like, people used to dress up. It's like you go back, you know, 40 years, 50 years, and people used to dress up as for coach. That went away first. And then now, like, you have people with juicy pants sitting in first class, you know, talking on speakerphone, like, you know, because they can't figure out how to use the phone.
Well, yeah. It's funny. You read the Reddits of the different airlines. It's pretty hysterical. It's the things that people do on airplanes and in first class in particular are interesting. But yeah, I feel like you're right, Seth. Like, the airlines have gotten smart with where the money is coming in. I don't think they understand necessarily the cost of that yet. Like, what have they actually lost? Because they just see the revenue, right?
People wearing coat and tie, just ask Foz.
Well, no, I mean, like, I'm talking, like, what have they lost in terms of, have they lost loyalty, right? Like, and that's hard to quantify because, yeah, you can look at your numbers, and if your numbers stay flat, you're like, okay, that's fine. You know, or they grow a little bit because someone else decides to fly you. That's great. But, like, are you looking at your revenue per passenger? I mean, I'm sure they are, but we don't have insight into any of that, right? So, I don't know.
There are definitely some numbers that the airlines have talked about around things like, you know, the passenger who is a member of the program just on average spends more with the airline than a passenger who's not. And the passenger who gets the credit card spends way more than even just the base member. So right now, right, the loyalty, the stickiness is coming from having the premium credit card, especially, or even the base card, but especially the premium card.
Yep.
And like, in some ways, if we want to, again, go back 20 years, Australians used to have to pay to be members of the Qantas Frequent Flyer program.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to get the best value of a program in the United States, generally passengers pay to have the premium card associated with the brand.
Yeah, fair.
Right? So that hasn't, how the transaction is happening has changed, but not the fact that you're paying. You're literally paying to be in it. And yes, there are benefits to that. And hopefully people are earning out the money they're putting in you know, some sort of reward return, but people are paying in.
Yeah. Because I'm such a I was a United centric flyer. I think, like, I see other knock on effects of this, right? Like San Francisco and the utilization of that as a hub for flyers. If you're a freaking flyer and you go through San Francisco, like, they charge you a premium to use San Francisco as the connecting hub. If you're not in San Francisco for domestic flights, like, that's the reality of San Francisco. Like, just look at the prices. So I wonder, like, what, like, the airlines have had to do a lot of manipulating to make this work, but it is working clearly.
Yeah, it isn't though, right? Like, when you go back, if you go to like 1995 and look at what a first class ticket was, it was astronomically high, right? Like, and so you didn't need to sell many to make the flight profitable.
Yeah.
And so the other thing is, right, the thing that people don't consider is, while often those cabins did not go out full, that was their elastic demand if they had irregular operations.
Well, and I was about to touch on that, like, 80% load factor or 85% load factor is considered the best, right? Because you have slack in the system. I don't know. Have you looked at load factors lately, Seth? Those load factors have to be higher. Like, every flight I've been on has been full.
Load factors, I think the optimal for recovery that we used to hear back in the day was high 70s, not into the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Load factors these days for the airlines are definitely in the low 80s.
Yeah.
And what that really comes down to is a lot of planes are 90% plus full, mm-hmm. and there's still a couple off-peak operations in certain areas which are not, and that skews it. But it's not, right? It's not that on average planes are only 70 or 80% full. It's that most are 90 to 95, and there's a couple empty seats here and there elsewhere.
Yeah.
And when you're sitting, when you're already up front, getting displaced is even harder to get rebooked now because there's very little inventory left at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a good point. Like, it's the ability to recover from these things, it seems very difficult. If things go bad, they go very badly, very quickly. So, yeah. There's one other point I was going to make, and now I can't remember what it was, or I was going to ask. Yeah. Anyway, we can probably talk about this all day. JetBlue, even more, is just free drinks now. Seth, what is this?
And that's sort of what we expect. So, certainly what I expected that even more to be. There was something went out for cabin crew training, and basically even more cabin, they're going to get a special snack, up to 3 free drinks and dedicated overhead bin space and a dedicated cabin crew, on board. How the dedicated crew thing works out, especially as the separate first class cabin comes along, will be interesting. Where you get like one flight attendant working both first and even more, or will one be dedicated to first, one dedicated to even more, and then one or two for core? I don't know. It'll be tough, but yeah, it's the new even more that they talked about how they're trying to make it more appealing and everything. I think a few free drinks makes sense because it's the easiest thing to implement.
Yeah.
On board, they already have a way to get free drinks out. They already know, you know, who's in those rows, whatever. The unique snack dedicated just for the even more will be, I don't know. I will reserve judgment until I learn what that actually is, and if it's actually something that matters. But
it's going to be the Alaska Airlines chocolate bar.
Yeah, then I will say it's probably right. Here's the thing, though: like, neither of those things is worth paying extra for. Certainly not at the $80 to $100 one way that even more comes in at.
Yeah,
space is probably worth paying for. Oh, then we can debate whether, you know, $180 on a transcon is worth it or not. You know, it's only $30 an hour, but no, I mean, less about.
Is it like 6? Is it like 6 inches, or how many inches of space? 3.
It's usually 3-ish more.
I don't know if that's worth it.
3 to 4, and it's 3 to, I think, and it's on top of already, like, it goes from like 32 to, maybe it goes from 32 to 36 to 38 kind of thing. So it's maybe 4 to 6 inches.
Yeah.
It depends on the configuration in the plane, and also the regular seats are also pretty spacious now. That is like, that potentially will change. One of the things that's come about is also that some of the exit row seats may now be reclassified as premium, not even more.
Hmm.
And I don't know if that's, you know, I don't know if they're going to re-space them or just change the designation because they want to have, you know, the even more stuff contiguous to the front or something else. But yeah.
Hmm. It's interesting. I mean, again, it's one of these things where it's like you're trying to differentiate a product. And I think it's going to become harder and harder now at this point, right? Like, where's the airlines go at this point? Like, are we going to get back to first class, business class, premium economy, coach on domestic configs? That would be wild.
It's close. Right. I mean, in some cases, the transcon configs, so right, the United's transcon, the, what we used to call PS.
Yep.
That premium transcon, the JetBlue Mint plane, right? Like, it is, you can call it first or business class. There's lie flat beds at the front, then extra leg room. Well, some of them, I think Delta said it's going to do 2-2 premium economy on those planes. And maybe the others follow. Then extra leg room, then regular. That's 4 physical different seats.
Hmm. Yeah.
And ironically, on relatively small planes or light seating planes.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
So
interesting times. Emirates A350. First special flight?
Yep. Edinburgh's now being served daily on the 350 from Dubai. They've announced that they're going to do Bahrain and Kuwait City. I want to say from the 8th, which is very soon considering they didn't have a second plane delivered yet. So, yeah. But they put out the release saying it was happening. Yeah, from 8 January, and so that's, I mean, we're recording this on the 5th, on Saturday, Sunday, sorry. They need that plane to show up in the next couple of days, because otherwise, the new schedule requires 2 frames.
Oh, interesting, okay.
It's a 16-inch hour round trip to Edinburgh, and you can't do 3 other round trips, even locally, in the remaining 8 hours of the day. Not with the flight schedules they've got.
Wow.
I closed that tab. I had it written down at one point, but I don't have it anymore. But it's like there's a midnight flight to Bahrain and back that gets back at like 4 in the morning. And that's while the other 350 is in Edinburgh or flying back from Edinburgh. Like, getting back at 8 a.m. or 7 a.m. So you definitely need 2 to do it. I hope that delivery happens in the next day or so.
Oh, man.
But yeah, these were markets that we knew were going to happen. And Emirates keeps announcing, you know, the next sort of tranche of markets that will also get the 350. And in their press release about the Edinburgh flight, they named a bunch more. See if I can find it here. Yeah. It's in this release somewhere, I saw it. Mumbai, Ahmedabad, Kuwait, Bahrain, Colombo, Lyon, Muscat, and Bologna. So we know that Kuwait and Bahrain are next. Previously, I think they had indicated Mumbai and Ahmedabad in India were happening. And so the other Sri Lanka, France, Oman, and Italy, you know, those are all coming in the next few months, they say.
Wow. So they've picked up quite a few deliveries then.
Yeah, I think someone said that they looked at the assembly line, and they're like the next 7 or 8 frames are all going to Emirates.
Oh, well.
Also, there's some nifty new stuff they're doing with the IFE system on board that I find interesting. But they've got they've had a sort of live TV option for a while now, a live event, sport events option and news. They sort of built a new UI around that that is like the special event. So, you know, F1 race is the example that was shared with me talking with Talis about how they're building it. You've got like an F1 race, and that's going to show live. But you also can have content around the season and interviews and other short form stuff that's sort of on the same page.
Hmm.
And then also potentially short form highlights that pop up very quickly.
Yeah.
Almost within an hour after the race ends, basically, they get redistributed over the satellite link, and all of a sudden you've got fresh content.
Hmm.
And DVR functionality built in. So if you go to the bathroom, you can actually pause the race.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And the DVR thing, JetBlue has had on some of its newest planes as well, also from the Avant system. So that part isn't unique. All the short stuff and sort of, and then the final part is like, again, with the F1, if the movie metadata is populated correctly, they can have like and here are movies about auto racing, and like, you know, Talladega Nights might show up, which obviously
let me guess they're also touting this as AI. Is that how they're
framed? I am sure AI would come up. I think they were smart enough not to use that term with me because they know I would call them out on it in the interview. But and this is an interview with Talis. I didn't talk to Emirates about it on this case, but they did not talk about AI, but they did talk about matching metadata and being smart about what they're doing. And it's the content companies talk about using AI to produce the metadata tags. So whatever. But
yeah.
I don't know. So the IFE stuff is pretty nifty. And that's the sort of thing I think we'll see more of coming around in the next, you know, whatever generations of IFE growth.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, that's the main show. We got some topics in the bonus for our Patreon subscribers. We're going to talk about some Alaska sketchiness with partner awards, some national slot time stuff, hidden passenger ticketing, and some stupid round the world ideas that we're going to talk about a bit, and also a happy hour coming up. So stick around for that if you're a Patreon subscriber. If not, thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting the show, and leave us a comment, tweet us, blue sky us. We'd like to hear from you. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Happy travels.
Take care.
Catch you next time.